house, which his father, Frank Wells, an insurance assessor, had bought in 1916 for £750. It had formerly been owned by Dulwich College, along with another three houses in the same street where Masters used to live. There were two older sisters in the family before Jerry. His mother, so he says, was not best pleased when she found she was pregnant with him.
"She said to my father, 'If I'm going to have another baby, I want some more luxuries this time, like hot and cold water and electricity. We didn't have any of those things until I was born. We just had gas.' But that year, a man called Percy Carlin went up and down the street canvassing, asking people if they would like electricity connected. When he got enough people saying yes, he went to the electric light company and got them interested. They agreed to lay on cables, so he went back, took orders and started wiring up the houses. My mother was terribly excited. We were at the top of Percy's list as she was pregnant. I've always thought that my love of all things electrical was therefore prenatally indoctrinated."
His passion became focused on radio, tinkering with crystal sets which were then beginning to be popular.
"Oh, I was obsessed. I thought of nothing else, which meant I was a disaster when it came to schoolwork, a total washout. I was sent to Dulwich Prep School and hated it. I was a legend at the time because I would never, ever conform. There was a boy who lived near us called Trevor Bailey. He was also at Dulwich Prep, but he was the model schoolboy, went on to play cricket for England, a shining example to little boys everywhere. My mother longed for me to be like Trevor Bailey. She was furious when I got into trouble and did awful things, such as during the war, going round the bombed-out houses and stealing all their electrical equipment. My sisters were ashamed of me as well, but my father was a gentleman. Rather than being furious with me, he was bewildered. He just couldn't work out why I'd turned out as I had done. During the war, it was decided that all the boys at Dulwich Prep were to be evacuated to the country, but my parents didn't want me to go, thinking I'd get into worse trouble away from home. So they sent me to St. Joseph's College, a Catholic school. I was still raiding bombed-out houses, stealing any electrical equipment, fuse boxes, lamp holders, even light meters, and riding off with them in the saddlebag of my bike. I made a trap door in the floor of the shed in our back garden, which I called my swag box, and that's wherein I hid my treasures. I then moved on to stealing from houses while people were still living there, like next door. I knew the people in the downstairs flat had a big Ferranti radio. While they were away, I went in and took it. I got it working and told my parents they had given it to me. I then took a Marconi from the upstairs flat, but was seen by my grandmother, who lived nearby, as I climbed over the garden wall. That evening the neighbour came to our house to report his Marconi radio was missing. He was very upset, so my parents gave him the Ferranti, which I had stolen from his house earlier that year. Oh, the disgrace. Alas, he had already reported the theft to the police, so I'd had it this time. Detective Sergeant Clutterbuck arrived at our house, searched the shed and found all the stuff I had stolen, and I was hauled up before Lambeth Juvenile Court. I was sent to Stamford House Remand Centre in Shepherd's Bush. They told my mother I'd be quite happy there. She replied that she didn't want me to be happy, she wanted me to suffer. Which I did. At the remand home, I was stripped and searched and made to wear this awful uniform made of canvas. For tea, we had a mug of cocoa and a slice of bread with dripping, then got turned out in an exercise yard ringed with barbed wire. I was there several weeks. A psychiatrist examined me and decided I had an average IQ, so I was released under the care of a probation officer. St. Joseph's College would not take me back, naturally enough. The only place that would take me after all that was a council school over in Brixton. The problem there was I didn't understand what the boys were saying, and they didn't understand me. I got expelled from there as well. More tea?
Aged 14, Jerry was riding his bike one day along Norwood High Street when he noticed Archie Root's radio shop. He went in, picked up a radio from the counter, ran out of the shop, jumped on his bike, and rode off.
"I suppose it was worth about £7 or £8. I didn't have that sort of money, and anyway, it seemed good fun to steal it. I wanted it so much. Unfortunately, I didn't know that Archie Root had an Austin 7 van. One of his boys who worked there jumped into it, drove after me and caught me in Chestnut Road. I was up in court and charged with stealing a radio. I remember one of the two women magistrates saying to me, "You are behaving as though you are writing a book about yourself." I didn't understand what she meant then, and I still don't. While I was on bail, I removed all the electrical fittings from a local vicarage that was empty. Every night I'd been going in and taking stuff. On the last night, with my last load, they caught me. The upshot was that he was sentenced to serve 3 years in an approved school. They decided to send him to one as far away as possible, out in the country, thinking this would keep him away from urban temptations like wires and plugs and sockets. The school was called Redbank at Newton Le Willows in Lancashire. I arrived on the 1st of January 1944 and was met by the headmaster, John Vardley. "What's the trouble, lad?" he asked. "I'm obsessed with wireless," I replied. "Oh, we've got a master like that, Reg Yates. Go and see him." I did, and he turned out to be a marvellous man and an excellent electrician. I loved it there. The first time I'd met an adult who was as keen on my hobby as I was. At the end of that year, on the 1st of November, the head called me in and gave me a train ticket to Euston, saying my father would meet me there. They were sending me home. I didn't want to leave, as I was loving it. They said it was now safe to go back to London, as the doodlebugs had finished, which was true, but they hadn't reckoned with the V2 rockets, which made an even bigger bang, and this time he didn't see them coming. A job was quickly found for Jerry, now that he was over 14, and a week later he started as an apprentice joiner with a local building firm. My father didn't have to pay a premium, which you had to do in those days to get an apprenticeship. It was done as a favour to my father by the chairman of the magistrates who had sentenced me, Basil Aldous. He was quite nice, really, unlike the two old ratbags who served on the bench with him. My father had done some insurance work for his building firm, so that was how I came to be fixed up with the apprenticeship. I stood it for about 3 years, by which time I was making more money by mending radios for the firm's customers than doing any joinery work. So I set myself up from home, repairing radios and doing electrical work. When I'd saved enough money, I built my own shed in the garden and used it as my workshop. My mother was still against all this, but my father agreed, thinking it would keep me out of mischief. In 1951, I bought the Austin 7 van, the one that had chased me, from Archie Root. I'd become a friend of his. I didn't realise till I got it home that he'd been carrying accumulators in it, and the acid had leaked and rotted the metal. You could push your fingers through the sides and floor. Anyway, I got it mended and set off to drive the 190 miles to Newton Le Willows to visit my old alma mater, the approved school. I fancied a few days' holiday and couldn't think of anywhere nicer to go. My mother thought I was balmy. Took me 6 hours in that old van with no heat and no radio. It was in late November, so it was very cold. I arrived to find that all the boys were rehearsing for a school pantomime, Jack and the Beanstalk. I was immediately given the job of doing all the lighting. If you ever want a good laugh, go and see boys from an approved school putting on a pantomime. It was hysterical, but I loved it, and stayed to the end and had a lovely holiday. His radio and electrical business expanded, and he was soon employing up to 3 other workers, with a girl in the house to answer the phone when they were out taking orders. Then, around 1970, he started to have health troubles. He'd been smoking 80 cigarettes a day, and working round the clock, never trusting his own men to do a job, thinking it would be easier if he did it himself rather than explaining it. Eileen came in one morning and found me lying down there on the kitchen floor. I'd had a heart attack, though I didn't know it. The ambulance was there in minutes. So quick they must have been passing outside, and I was rushed to hospital. All the doctors had cricketers' names, but I must admit they were brilliant. I recovered from that, then had 2 strangulated double hernias. Oh, it was hellish. The pain was so loud you could hear it. I took months to get better, and I was then told I should never work again, damn it, that I should give up my business and take it easy. They said I'd done my share. I realised I couldn't go forward any more, so I thought, I know, I'll go backwards instead. I'd been to visit Lord Montague's collection of vintage motor cars at Bewley, as I'd always been interested in cars. That got me thinking about starting a collection of old radios, the sort I'd worked on when I was young. There was another moment of inspiration, or at least enlightenment, which happened around the same time. I was in the back garden one day, and this big brash Yank was leaning over the wall, taking a photo of the back of our house. I asked him what he was doing, and he said his mother used to live in this house. His mother then appeared, and she was refined and ladylike. She explained that her husband, Alfred Richard Taylor, had lived in this house. He'd been a master at Dulwich College, she said, and had been very interested in wirelesses. At once, I realised who he was, the Alfred Richard Taylor. I knew his name by now, as I'd been studying the early years of the wireless. Everyone in wireless knows his name, because he was one of the earliest wireless pioneers, a total amateur, but very skilful, who did his own broadcasts, and in 1908 had his own call signal, 2AF, broadcasting from our house. I knew of him, that he'd been a master at Dulwich College, but until that day I never knew he'd lived here. All I ever knew was that my father had bought this house from Dulwich College, not the name of the man who had lived here. Alfred Richard Taylor had started the first engineering group at Dulwich College. It was aimed at the dull types, who couldn't do Latin or Greek, and were too lazy or slow to march. It was so strange to realise he had been living here all those years ago, in this very house, fiddling with his radios. That was the second big prenatal influence in my life, even though I had never been aware of it. But it must have been in the air. After all, there were no collecting genes in my family, and my father was never interested in radios, nor was my mother. My family, until me, had all been in banking or insurance or the church. I was the black sheep. Jerry started collecting as many old radios as possible, and got them operating, also repairing them for other people. He also built repro models, complete with fancy woodwork. Eileen helped me with the fretwork. She turned out to be pretty nifty with a screwdriver. I started a vintage wireless society, the first in the UK, and members used to meet here. It then spread around the country. There were quite a few wireless clubs at that time, and some members had their own little museums. His Museum of Vintage Radios opened to the public in 1974, with proper opening hours, welcoming all comers, and very soon was attracting a lot of people and a lot of attention. He appeared on a couple of TV magazine programmes in 1978, such as Nationwide. It was only 10 minutes, but afterwards I got sacks and sacks of mail. The National Theatre started borrowing my stuff for props, and so did film and TV people. Did you ever see The Russian Bride? I provided all the props for that. It was always a struggle, though, with little money coming in. As the collection grew, he expanded into more rooms, adapting halls and corridors and any available bit of space, as well as creating a workshop for repairing radios. Eventually, every bedroom got filled with his display, including his own. But it was proving more expensive to run than he had expected, what with trying to equip the bedrooms with proper display units and shelves, even though he knocked up most of them himself. He was beginning to think he might have to get a proper job and run the museum part-time when a saviour appeared. In 1980, Christie's had a sale of EMI archives and collections, which attracted quite a lot of publicity. One of the more interesting lots was a 1924 HMV Lumiere, the world's first radiogram. It was bought by Paul Getty, the son of John Paul Getty, who later became Sir Paul Getty when he was knighted for his philanthropic work, helping various British cultural institutions. He didn't bid for the old radiogram personally, but sent an assistant along. Alas, when he got it home, he found he couldn't get it to work. Someone then told him about Jerry and his work on old radios, and one day Jerry got a phone call asking if he could repair an old radiogram.
There had been a feature on me in my museum in Sounds Vintage magazine, now no more, which someone must have read.
Jerry went along to Paul Getty's house in Cheney Walk, the house in which Christina Rossetti had once lived. Getty was known as a bit of a recluse, staying indoors a lot, playing music on old gramophones, reading through his collection of rare books. When younger, he'd suffered from various problems. One of his neighbours was Mick Jagger, who became worried about him, especially when he seemed to stay in for weeks at a time. Getty told Jerry that one evening, Jagger had barged into his house and switched on the TV, insisting they watched the cricket together. And from then on, according to Jerry, Getty developed a passion for cricket, which resulted in him contributing to help rebuild Lord's cricket ground. Back to the radiogram, which I managed to steer Jerry towards, as once he starts a story it is hard to interrupt or cross-examine him. What happened to that? Did he get it working?
Oh, yes, I got it working okay and sent him the bill, which I think was for £60. He paid up prompt. This was in the September. In December, a food hamper arrived from Harrods and a cheque for £1,000 towards my museum. It was just what I needed, and came at a vital time. Then, in the January, I got a phone call from a Scottish woman who said she was a chief accountant at Deloitte's, Getty's accountants. She just wanted to come and check to see if the £1,000 had gone to my museum, that I really did have a museum. She said she'd only stop for a moment, leave the car running, pop inside, then out again. When she arrived, she looked to me like a hospital matron, grey-haired bun, tweed suit, very smart and efficient. She asked me what my charity number was. I had no idea what she was talking about. I wasn't a charity. Anyway, on that first visit, she ended up staying 2 hours. She went round everything and saw what I was trying to do. I did have a couple of sheds in the garden by then, but I needed more space. There was a spare bit of land adjoining the bottom of my garden which I was longing to have, but of course couldn't afford it. She must have told Sir Paul about it, because the next thing I knew, I was being given a cheque for £8,000. The neighbours who owned the land were delighted to accept it.
Sir Paul then followed it up with further generosity, offering to pay all Jerry's council taxes, something else he'd been worried about, plus all his electricity bills. Sir Paul himself visited Jerry in his museum a couple of times. This continued every year from then on, till Getty's death in 2003.
I went to his memorial service, as he was a wonderful man and very knowledgeable about lots of things, but after his death the money stopped.
However, since Getty's death, Jerry has done the obvious and sensible thing which many small-time specialist museums do, which was to turn the museum into a charity. With the help of a group of enthusiasts and supporters, a trust has been set up to look after the museum and secure its future. During his lifetime, Getty did hand over to the museum the 1924 radiogram, the one he had bought at Christie's, and also another equally rare item, a 1937 television radiogram, the RGD-235DT, to give it its correct title. This is one of the world's first radio, gramophone and TV units all in the same cabinet. We were sitting during all this chat, or at least monologue, at a table in Jerry's front room, about the only space in the whole house to sit down, although even here we were surrounded by old radios and TVs. Along the whole of one wall was a massive 1930s TV radiogram, a huge piece of Art Deco-like furniture, made of walnut and highly polished. He opened the top, and I could see the gramophone turntable and also a small screen set flat into the cabinet. Jerry went off into the kitchen where four elderly men were now sitting. They had been arriving in dribs and drabs, going into the kitchen and making themselves tea. Jerry explained that every Friday morning he had open house for a group of his supporters.
I give them all rude names, but they don't know. I call them the Little Old Men Club.
I followed Jerry into the kitchen where he introduced me to the men. They were all supping tea and chatting while playing with valves. Each time the doorbell rang and another old man arrived, Jerry shouted,
See who seeks admission.
He went to a cupboard in the kitchen, switched on some plugs, and we returned to his front room where we stood in front of his monster TV radiogram. He explained that he had rigged up an ancient BBC transmitter, which had once been in use at the old Crystal Palace, and this was how he could get the 1930s TV screen to work. As we waited, it eventually did start flickering into life. I peered forward, and the pictures on the screen were pretty good, in black and white, of course, but also upside down. But aha, that is not the way you watched TV on this machine in the 1930s. Jerry opened up the lid of the cabinet to its full height, and inside it was a large mirror on which the TV picture was reflected, the right way up, and much bigger. By moving the mirror around, you could watch the TV from anywhere in the room, without having to bend down and look inside at the actual screen. Damn clever. But why on earth did they do it that way?
Ah, well, you should see the size of the transistor inside. It's about 5 feet long. To get it inside the cabinet, they had to put the TV screen in upside down, but they got round that with the use of a mirror. Ingenious, don't you think?
He showed me how various other radios and TVs worked, not that I quite understood it all. Despite the room, like all the others, being crammed with stuff, he seemed to know where everything was, partly because he has made no changes and done no modernization for many years. The furniture and wallpaper looked straight out of the 1950s. All the same, it seemed quite tidy.
Oh, Eileen comes in every day, does a bit of cleaning, sees I'm okay, checks I'm still alive. It was Eileen who found me that time I had a fall, and it was she who called the ambulance.
There had been quite a few references to Eileen, who seemed to be a regular presence, so I wondered who she was. He explained that she was a local girl who came to help in the days when he had his own electrical business and hired girls to answer the phone, look after things, keep the place tidy when he was out on a job.
When I was making repro radios and TVs, I discovered she could use a screwdriver, so she worked with me. She was very good, excellent at woodwork. We made a good little team. She's now married, has a family of her own, but she still comes in to keep an eye on me. I look upon her as my daughter, but she's not. When I was in my 20s and 30s, I did have a few ding-dongs, but we needn't go into them. So I have no children, as far as I know. The first time I fell madly in love was when I was about 14. She was called Barbara Allen, and she was about 12. I met her at a youth club, and for a few months we used to go everywhere together. I felt I was walking on air. I knew she had other friends, and they all thought I was boring playing with my radios. I was very jealous of them, but I was head over heels in love. We used to sit in my shed, kissing and cuddling for hours, which got my mother very worried. One day, she came to my shed with her bicycle lamp. It had got broken, and she asked me to mend it. As we talked, it came out she was going to a party that night, and I hadn't been invited. I was so insanely jealous that I picked up a hammer and smashed her bike lamp. She picked up the pieces, left the shed, and walked out of my life forever. That was on the 5th of January, 1946. For about 50 years, I always held a little party on the 5th of January each year to cheer myself up. I suppose that was the biggest romance in my life. What it did teach me was not to be jealous of anyone and not to lose my temper, and I've tried to stick to both of those principles ever since.
We then did a tour of the museum, working our way round the old men in the kitchen, still deep in heated conversation about valves and transistors. In his bedroom at the back of the house, right beside his bed, Jerry had rigged up his own tape deck. He switched it on, and instantly I could hear the sounds of palm court music from the 1950s, the Max Jaffa sort my parents listened to when I was a boy. As we progressed, the music followed us round the whole house, and even outside into his sheds, as he has rigged up 19 speakers to cover every room. The tape deck was made of plywood, painted black, rather crude and amateurish, and clearly homemade, but it certainly worked efficiently. Just as well, with perfect sound, as any modern Wizzo sound system. He said he had a stock of 5,000 records, all vinyl, each of which he could play at the touch of a switch.
I used to make quite a few of these tape decks in the 1950s. It was when disc jockeys were first coming in, but they still had to make their own table and tape deck and rig up their own speakers. I sold them to various holiday camps, the cheap, tatty sort. They would have hired a DJ for dances, but had nowhere for them to play their records. So I made them a tape deck and worked out a way for them to mix their records. This one is the last one I ever made. Once mass production came in, no one wanted my homemade ones anymore. This one has a pure valve sound, so it sounds like the sort of music you heard on the radio in the 1950s. Real music with melodies, not like this modern rubbish which I call council house music.
He also used to make working repro models of Britain's rarest radio, a green 1934 Echo AD-68. Original Echo radios were sold in the 1930s for 9 guineas each, which was expensive. Only two were ever made in green, and they were exhibited in a plastics exhibition to show that Bakelite could be made in different colours. After the exhibition, the two green radios were being chucked out, as they had been for display purposes only. However, a man who worked at the Echo factory decided to save them, putting in the right parts from the factory to make them work. Then they disappeared.
About 20 years later, one of them turned up in a junk shop in Honor Oak, priced at £150. A man contacted me to ask if it could be genuine, so I went to see it and said it was authentic, though by now it didn't play. It was then advertised for 15,000. In fact, it was sold for 17,500. That's a world record for an old radio. But the last time I heard, it had changed hands for 8,000.
The market has apparently fallen out of old radios because all the systems have changed. The modern signals can't be picked up on old valves anymore, or something like that. Until about 20 years ago, you could repair an old radio or build a repro one, if you were clever like Jerry, and tune it in to present-day BBC stations.
I used to do a good trade in repro echoes, making them in my workshop. People couldn't really tell the difference. I made about 80 in all and sold them for £150 each. Eileen helped me with the fretwork. Then it turned out the material we were using to fix the wood got banned. It was found to contain cyanide, so we had to pack that up. Anyway, once you can't play old radios, they become ornaments only and lose part of their attraction.
Upstairs, the house's original 5 bedrooms and every nook and cranny and landing have been converted into museum rooms. He was able to do this after 1957 when his mother died. She left him the house while his sisters got some money. Each room has a different name, after a well-known collector, a sponsor of the museum, or a place name which means something to radio fans, such as Droitwich or Daventry. Sometimes he gives a room a rude name, which is self-explanatory, such as the Gas Smell Room.
I've never bought an old radio. Everything has been given to me, or, I nicked them many years ago. When my museum appeared now and again on those old TV programs, I always got masses of offers. People saying I could have their old radios if I took them away. That still happens now and again, but I keep a lower profile today, now I'm appointment only.
In the Sir Paul Getty room, he showed me the 1924 Lumiere radiogram. This has a strange sort of cover above the turntable, shaped like a circular fan, which holds the needle. He explained this was to make the needle stable. He turned it on, and the record started playing. Walter Glynn singing Passing By. Ah, what memories. That used to be one of my mother's favourite songs. In another room was a large collection of Roberts radios.
Dick Roberts, began his firm in 1928. He was a good friend of mine.
One room was named John Vardy, after the head of the approved school he liked so much. When he died, he left some money to the museum.
"I was born in this room," said Jerry, opening another door.
Inside, it was arranged exactly like a 1936 radio shop, with an original counter and all the shelves and boxes and displays and illuminated period advertisements, which lit up when he pressed a switch. The oldest item in the museum is an 1899 Sparks transmitter, whatever that is. He also has an early Baird television set dated 1933. Jerry insisted we climbed up the final set of stairs to his loft, though his legs and voice appeared to be weakening, which was not surprising, as he had not stopped talking for the 2 hours since I'd arrived. He had converted the loft himself, turning it into one huge room. At one time, he used to have meetings here with members of the radio club, and also played table tennis. One of the walls is covered with the ornate wooden honours board that once belonged to the Dulwich High School for Girls.
"It was being chucked out when someone heard I was converting my loft and offered it to me to use as a wall."
On the top, in ornate scroll, I could read the lettering, "The Utmost for the Highest." Below are the names of girls from 1882 to 1937, mostly long dead by now, but stars in their time, honoured by fellow pupils and staff for their academic achievements. Historic stuff.
"Oh, it is. Yet probably only once in about 30 years has someone asked to look at it, researching the history of their family. So many of those surnames were well known in Dulwich. I'm glad I saved it, because no one else would have done. Councils and government bodies, they have no interest in the past."
I looked down the honours board, noting the Victorian Christian names like Florence, Amy, Fanny.
"Yes, there were a lot of Fannies. Let's hope none of them became a gynaecologist."
Jerry's jokes, like his old radios, tend to be a bit of their time, and probably wouldn't go down well in mixed company today, but his little old men, when we met them on the stairs or in one of the rooms, laughed heartily every time. Finally, we went out into the garden to inspect the sheds. I hadn't realised there were so many. Once he got that extra bit of land, he went on to build a veritable village of sheds, some very elaborate with gable roofs and internal courtyards. This accounts for the fact that in all, counting both house and sheds, he has a total of 13 different rooms devoted to his old radios and associated bits. One large shed is a schoolroom, arranged with 6 little workstations, where he still has Sunday afternoon workshops for people who want to learn how to mend old radios and TVs. The workstations seemed very well equipped, with glass blowing and welding facilities, though several did look a bit worn and dusty, as if they were not used as often as in the past. As we wandered round, we found one or two of the little old men crouched over a machine or studying old diagrams, searching through drawers and cupboards. His store cupboards looked chaotic to me, with drawers and little cubbyholes piled high and jam-packed, but Jerry maintained he knew where everything was.
"Because we are not computerized, I guarantee I can find anything in 3 minutes flat."
One old man came over and wanted a certain valve. Sure enough, Jerry had located it in 90 seconds.
"Look at this HMV resistor," said another old man, handing something to Jerry. "They shouldn't go like that."
"They do if they've had a bomb under them," replied Jerry, "or a radio rentals engineer has tried to mend it."
The old man guffawed, then padded away back to playing happily with his old radio. As we walked back up the garden to the house across the large lawn, Jerry reminisced about all the good times he'd had in the garden.
"We have had lots of garden parties here, feeding over 100 people, barbecues, tables laid out, cocktails, proper meals. We had a huge one in 1984 when 28 members of the Antique Wireless Association of America flew over with their partners,
and they had 3 days of events and celebrations with our BVWS members. Oh, it was a wonderful time with music and dancing.
BVWS stands for the British Vintage Wireless Society, an organisation that has been going since 1976 and still has over 1,700 members. An impressive number, considering that many of them must be pretty old by now.
That's true, but people do have an emotional connection with their old radios. You'd be surprised how important they are, reminding them of times past, what they used to listen to, when and with whom.
Talking to the little old men, I discovered that several had worked as BBC engineers in the old days, so had grown up with what are now vintage radios. The next generation will not have that experience and knowledge. Did Jerry worry about the future of the museum?
Not at all. We have at present a very strong core of enthusiasts. They spend a lot of time here and help with the museum. They are determined to keep it going, whatever happens to me. In the past, we've had a few who didn't quite see eye to eye with each other. The trouble with enthusiasts is that some don't turn out to be the most reliable or, shall I say, stable. Especially when you have a lot of old men, they can be very cantankerous. We have people who have fallen out, then they go away and try to cause trouble. We have an excellent committee and trustees, and they will make sure everything is preserved and looked after when I am gone.
So who will take over running the actual museum?
Eileen, of course. She's a trustee and general manager. She knows where everything is and all about the museum as she's worked with me for many years. Her own daughter, Nicola, is also getting very knowledgeable. I have no worries about the future. She and the committee have looked after me well in the past, and I know they'll look after all this in the future.
The little old men had all come in from their various sheds where they had been pottering around, and were waiting for Jerry to stop talking to me.
It's my big treat of the week. Every Friday when they come round, I go out with them at the end of the day for my only outing of the week. They take me to a greasy spoon caff. I then get my cholesterol top-up for the week. Not that I'm totally helpless. I can do a roast dinner if I want to, but I do tend to stick to the same old things like tea and biscuits. And when I go anywhere, it's usually just for a week's holiday at the same place, a geriatric holiday village on Hailing Island. They know me well there. I wrote my book while I was there, spread over about 5 years. While the other geriatrics were playing bowls, I got peace and quiet to get on with my book while the staff supplied me with constant tea and biscuits.
His book, Obsession, about his life in wireless, was published by the BVWS in 2002, free to members or £6 to the public. Unlike Hélène at the Fan Museum, Jerry is proud to call himself an obsessive, which he clearly is, always has been, a prime example of someone whose obsession took over his life and who, in the end, made his obsession work, turning it into a career. Until then, many people had thought him a bit strange, perhaps mad, if not exactly wicked. Sending him away to a remand home did seem a bit excessive, but obsessives can sometimes appear a threat. In the end, his obsession gave him a life and purpose and amusement, for Jerry is full of fun and obviously enjoys looking like a mad boffin. I had arrived with no knowledge or interest in old wirelesses, but I have to admit I came away inspired to look out for them from now on. And there were quite a few objects I would like to have taken with me, if I could have carried them. Some were a bit big, such as the monster 1930s TV radiogram. The thing about old wirelesses is that even when they don't work, they do look decorative, with all the polished wood and fancy fretwork and nice bits of inlay. I would love to have his 1924 Lumiere radiogram, the one he got from Getty, the fan-shaped one, along with the record of Passing By. What fun to wind it up and turn it on. How our smart dinner party guests would love it. Except we don't have smart dinners or smart guests anymore. But my four grandchildren, God, they would be in ecstasy. Far cleverer and more entertaining than any boring old computer game or Peapod or Blackcurrant. Jerry's enthusiasm for his subject, I'd like to have that, and be able to rattle and prattle away to strange visitors, as if they were the first people he had ever told about his obsession. And his sense of humour, still intact after all these years. You need both these qualities if you are going to open your own museum and keep it open. Before I left, I asked if he wore his white coat all the time.
Yes. Every day when I get up I put it on. I started wearing them in 1946 when I had my business and was going round all the time mending radios and TVs and electrical things. I found that after 6 months I had to put it in the dustbin as it was covered in burn holes from the soldering irons or from battery acid and other things. Since then, I've bought a new one every 6 months. I reckon I must have gone through 100 of them by now. They're technically lab coats, and when I first started buying them, they cost 30 shillings. Not sure what they cost now. I'm famous in the vintage wireless world for wearing them. It's my trademark. There is one collector who, along with his vintage radios, has one of my old white coats displayed as part of his wireless collection. I won't tell you his name. Don't want to embarrass him.
How nice to think that not only will the museum Jerry Wells has created go on forever, or so he fondly expects, but that somewhere one of his white coats is being carefully preserved. The British Vintage Wireless and Television Museum, 23 Rosendale Road, West Dulwich, London SE21 8DS. Telephone 0208 670 3667. bvwm.org.uk. Chapter 3. Bath Postal Museum. Fans and radios were both new to me, subjects I'd had no knowledge of or interest in. But now, of course, I find them totally fascinating. Oh, yes, and always will. Go on, ask me anything. But now I was on the train to Bath, on the trail of a subject I like to think I do know something about. The world's biggest collecting hobby, or so they always say. It was stamps I first came back to when I became a born-again collector in my 40s, so I can't say I'd always been obsessed by them, as Jerry had been about old radios, nor had there been some tragedy in my life to make me pick them up, as with Helene, hoping to find some sort of solace. Unless you count giving up football. That did throw me back, when I realised I was still fit enough to play football, but not fit enough to recover from playing football. When I realised my knees had gone, I knew that was it. But what was I going to do at weekends from now on to give myself another interest? Perhaps deep down I was looking for some displacement activity to save myself from mischief, from getting into less wholesome pastimes. Collecting, after all, is a form of escape. But we needn't go into that. So, I decided to go back to collecting stamps, as I had as a boy, and found it had all changed. No more sticky gums, but little plastic folders. The language seemed to have changed as well, much more academic and scientific. I thrashed around all over the place, up different routes and alleyways, trying to get one of every GB stamp, trying to collect penny blacks with different letters on. I collected thematic stamps, meaning on one theme, such as railways. I collected Wembley stamps, from the 1924-5 Wembley exhibition, and also postal history, envelopes, or covers, as they are called amongst collectors, showing Cumbrian postmarks. I then did a really dopey thing which I had never done before and have never done since, which I know is stupid, and about which I warn every new collector I meet, never, ever buy as an investment, not if you really are a collector. I paid Stanley Gibbons £5,000 to arrange a portfolio of stamps for me, and 10 years later I sold them for £1,500. I had bought at the height, which was bad luck, but I also allowed Gibbons to pick them for me from places and periods I had no interest in. Then I put them in the bank, so I didn't even get pleasure out of them while I had them. What a mistake! Always buy for fun. Then, if stuff you have goes up in value, that's an extra bonus. Would I experience a little flutter of excitement to see some really choice stamps once again? Would I get derailed when I realised just how many different and tantalising museums there are in Bath? The whole of Bath is, of course, a museum. The Georgian streets and terraces go on forever, even when you think this must be it. Some council houses will be round the next corner, a 60s concrete tower block will soon rise up, Pound Stretcher and Iceland can't be far away. But no, beauty and good taste and architectural wonders as far as the eye can see. I wonder if Bathonians get so used to living in a masterpiece that going to an ordinary run-of-the-mill British town like, say, Motherwell or Margate makes them think, how exotic, how unusual. I must have a long weekend here and really explore. The only problem with living in a masterpiece is that everyone and his wife wants to visit the town, then stand around and gape, getting in your way when you want to be on with the everyday business of living and working. Bath streets seem to hide their names, or do without them. I was constantly being asked the way by total strangers. I must have given the impression I knew where I was going. As if. Outside the Jane Austen Centre in Gay Street, there was a woman in a bonnet and period blue coat, standing beside a man dressed as an 18th-century gentleman. The man moved to greet some Americans going in, which was when I realised that he was real while the woman was a model. "Is it Jane Austen?" I asked the gentleman, who had very fine side whiskers and an excellent West Country accent, straight out of a Radio 4 afternoon play. "No, sir, Miss Austen, I think you'll find, was taller, and had hazel eyes, not blue eyes. This is Elizabeth Bennet." "Of course, silly me. And what about you? Apart from a gentleman of the period, are you supposed to be someone in particular?" "Probably Dr. Mapleton." "Oh, which novel was he in?" "He was real, sir, lived locally in Bath, and looked after Miss Austen. As for fictional characters, I could be Darcy, Mr. Collins, or Captain Wentworth." "Excellent. Excellent," I said. "Do carry on." I found the Bath Postal Museum at last, hidden away down some stairs in the basement of Bath's main post office, at the corner of Broad Street and Green Street. I did notice a Stanner stairlift, not working the day I was there, which must be a help to those with even worse knees than mine. You enter a 1930s post office, complete with wooden counter and pigeonholes, plus adverts and packets of household goods from the time. Some jaunty period tunes were being played in the background to aid the atmosphere. It is a real post office, which used to be in the Wiltshire village of Neston, untouched till it ceased trading in 1961, and eventually moved to the museum as a job lot. Before I could start poking around and exploring inside, Audrey Swindells herself, co-founder of the museum, appeared, a bustling, energetic lady in her early 80s. If I wanted to talk to her, she said, it was best to go across the road to the church. Her museum didn't do refreshments, but the church had a good tea room where we could talk in peace. Audrey Stevens, as she was born in Birmingham in 1928. When she left school, she worked mainly as a secretary in various offices, then got married and had three children. The marriage collapsed, and she moved back in with her parents, who by then were living in Bath. It was in Bath that she met Harold Swindells, some 8 years older than herself. They married in 1957, and in 2 years had three children, including twins. Oh, he did get teased. He'd been a bachelor all those years, then in the space of 2 years he was married with six children. As a boy, Harold had been a chorister at Manchester Cathedral, but his real passion in life, from the age of six, had been stamps. On leaving school he worked in the rag trade and in timber, till he set himself up as a stamp dealer, opening a stamp shop in Stockport. In those days, not long after the war, before TV, every half-decent-sized town in Britain had a stamp shop, if not two, and Harold's Stockport shop did quite well. Someone told him that a stamp shop in Bath was up for sale, which had a much better location and clientele, so in the mid-1950s he bought it and moved to Bath. "I knew nothing about stamps till I met Harold," said Audrey. "As a girl, I was much more interested in the theatre. When we got married, I did the secretarial side, the bills and tax and all that, but gradually I became interested in the postal history side, rather than the actual stamps. I began collecting things like balances, which post offices used to weigh envelopes, and also prints of mail coaches. I became interested in coins as well, which we also began to sell in the shop." She never found having the name Swindells much of an embarrassment, though Harold did tell her the correct pronunciation was Swindells in two clear syllables. "I've heard most of the jokes over the years. Luckily, we never put Swindell's stamp shop over the door. It's always been the Bath stamp shop. It's not such a bad name. People do remember it. The funniest name I ever saw was when I was driving through Bridgnorth once, and I saw solicitors called Doolittle and Dally. They must have had to put up with the same old jokes every day." Talk of opening a postal history museum in Bath had gone on for some years, as Bath has played a vital part in the history of the postal service, and there have always been many enthusiastic and knowledgeable local collectors, some of them quite wealthy. "I remember discussing it with four people we knew, all millionaires. One was Charles Robertson of the jam firm and Carl Jaeger of the clothing firm. They were all keen collectors and keen on a museum, but when it came to getting any of them to put up the money, I got nowhere. I soon discovered that if you are setting up a museum, you don't really get much help till people can actually see it. When it's up and running, if it's any good, that's when you'll get lots of help." In 1977, despite having a large family to bring up and support, Audrey and Harold put up their own money and bought premises at 51 Great Pulteney Street. They lived in the house and started to convert the lower ground floor into a postal museum, borrowing most of the items on long-term loans from collectors, establishing a charitable trust which would own and run the museum. It opened in 1979, with a grand ceremony filling the streets of Bath with a liberation of 250 pigeons, a period mail coach with Martin Haller blowing the post horn, the landing of a helicopter from HMS Birmingham, and people in 19th-century costumes. They quickly acquired more material and soon outgrew their space. In 1985, they moved to bigger, council-owned premises in Broad Street, in a building that had been Bath's main post office from 1822 to 1853. They had an even grander grand opening this time, as Audrey does like a good party, and is also clearly a whiz at PR and contacts and organising people. She rang Clarence House, hoping to contact the Queen Mother. "I got through and spoke to someone explaining we were opening the Bath Postal Museum, and I wondered if the Queen Mother would send a pigeon-gram to celebrate our opening. I explained that's a message sent inside a little metal container, the sort which pigeons used to carry during the war. I later heard from an equerry, Sir Martin something or other, who said Her Majesty would be delighted." So, on the museum's opening day, a carrier pigeon left Clarence House and was in Bath 3.5 hours later, carrying the welcome message from the Queen Mother. Again, they had a real mail coach, gentlemen in period costume, plus this time two very popular celebs of the day, Leslie Crowther, star of a TV show called Crackerjack, and Richard Briers, greatly loved for his part in The Good Life. They agreed to perform the opening ceremony for nothing, thanks to Audrey, who knew that both happened to be stamp collectors. "They were doing the opening ceremony just as the pigeon arrived, so all the crowds and TV cameras, we had two crews from BBC Bristol and HTV in Wales, turned instead to watch the pigeon being carried in by his handler. I heard Leslie turn to Richard and say, 'Is this the first time you've been upstaged by a pigeon?'" In 2005 came problems, the sort all little museums can face, even if they think they are making local waves and creating attention that will help them forever. They were told they were having a massive rental increase, up from £5,500 to £43,000. I couldn't believe it. I knew we'd had a subsidised rent till then, but I hadn't realised what they thought the true rent should be. The council at that time was intent on getting what the government was calling best value from all their resources. We just couldn't manage it. Despite our success, we had never run at a profit, so it did look as if we would have to close forever. However, a local councillor told me about a property developer who might help us, Stephen Green, who was setting up something called Future Heritage. In an hour, I was on the phone to him. The upshot was he found us premises very near, in the same street, in the basement of the present post office. He gave us a 15-year lease, which we'd never had before, at only £7,500 a year. Then came the problem of equipping the new museum, with up-to-date audio and visual displays, which all museums these days seem to be convinced they need. Otherwise, how will they ever attract anyone under the age of 13? The trustees worked out they would need £270,000, and three of them began applying to the National Lottery for funding. It took a year, but they got it, or at least 90% of it, and the rest of it they raised themselves. The museum reopened once again for the third time in 2007. Such perseverance. They don't have as much space in their present basement as they had previously, and a vast amount of their material is not on show but kept in their archives. Not surprisingly, visitor numbers have fallen slightly, from a high of about 12,000 a year to around 10,000. They are not making a profit, and struggle to raise money, but have always had excellent voluntary support, managing to run the museum with only two part-time paid staff and the rest volunteers. Audrey herself does around 2 days a week, unpaid, and she's clearly still the driving force. Harold, aged 89, rarely comes in these days as his short-term memory is not what it was, but he is eager to be kept informed about their activities and progress. I asked if being in Bath was a help or handicap, with so many rival museums and attractions. Bath itself is a huge draw, and there are loads of tourists, so the cake is bigger than in most places, but we all have to fight hard for our share. The trouble many places like ours have is getting volunteer help. There are not really enough volunteers to go round, as there are so many interesting places in Bath to do voluntary work. We have done quite well since moving here. Volunteers quite like telling people they work in the museum under the post office. It seems to be a sort of status symbol. Our biggest problem is actually the problem of stamps. When you tell people about this museum, they say, "Oh, we don't collect stamps. No one in our family is interested." We then say, "It's not about stamps. It's about communication, the history of it over the centuries." Once kids are dragged along, they rarely want to leave. There's so many buttons for them to press, things to do. But getting them in when they hear the word stamps, that's the big struggle. Alas, I have to agree. Despite that boast about being the biggest collecting hobby, I suspect the great days of stamp collecting are over. All kids at one time collected stamps. Every school had a stamp club. When I became a born-again collector in 1979, there were still 30 or so stamp shops and dealers in the Covent Garden and Strand area alone. Now at least two-thirds have gone. I should think the demise of Woolies has added to the decline. That was where many children got their starter pack and cheapo album. At the top end, philatelists do tend to appear a bit snobbish and elitist with their arcane rules and awards, institutions and language. And at the bottom, collecting stamps projects a geeky, boring, specky image. When almost all kids collected stamps in their childhood, they had had an involvement, a knowledge, which helped bring them back into the fold in their middle years, as happened with me. Now these possible returnees, who might be thinking again about some sort of collecting, have a mass of rival attractions, and also other new and unusual things they could be collecting. Adult collectors are more independent and original these days, willing to strike out on their own into new areas, rather than boring old stamps. The fact that we no longer have a National Postal Museum in London is another sign of the times. I used to haunt it when I became born again, as its collections were so rare. It closed in 1998. After a scandal involving some of the stamp treasures allegedly disappearing. Audrey did not quite agree with all my observations, but she is well aware that the stamp world is in danger, which is very sad for future generations. You can learn so much from stamps, such as history and geography and politics.